Hello and welcome to A Changing Landscape, the GSC Grays podcast. This series of podcasts will address some of the most pressing challenges and exciting opportunities facing farmers and landowners today, from the loss of BPS and the overhaul of agricultural policy to growing your business, diversification and planning for the future. In the first part of our 2021 programme, we are putting a spotlight on diversification. Many farm businesses have already diversified, and the changes to farm support may encourage even more farmers to look beyond their core agricultural enterprise for a new source of income. If you approach diversification with an open mind, there is a huge variety of opportunities, so much so that the challenge can often be working out which one best suits you, your land, and your business objectives. It's not just about farm shops or glamping pods. For those in search of a less hands-on or public-facing opportunity with a secure but significant income, then a solar development might seem like an ideal solution. But how do solar farms actually work? Who pays for them? What are the risks? And how do you know if you have suitable land? I put these questions to two of our rural directors and solar specialists, John Wallace and Chris Thayer. Chris has been with GSC Grays since graduating in 2012. With clients across the country, he enjoys the diversity of people he meets and places he visits in his role. He started his career in estate management before specialising in energy, telecoms, planning and compulsory purchase, and has since worked on renewable energy schemes from Cornwall to Caithness. John Wallace joined GSC Grays in 2013, also starting his career in estate management, and has a particular focus on rural sporting estates. In recent years, John has also developed his interest in renewables and now works closely alongside Chris to advise clients across the north of England on solar developments. Later in the episode, we will also be joined by Mark Hinton, a GSC Grays client, to share his first-hand experience of solar development. And our thanks go to Mark for contributing to the episode. Thank you, Chris and John, for joining me. We have a lot to talk about, but I think we should start off with some basics. Chris, you have a lot of experience in identifying potential solar sites for our clients and also working closely with developers. Could you perhaps start us off by telling us, what does the ideal site look like? How do people know if they have a suitable site?
The best site is generally going to be a big piece of land, ideally 200 acres or so. You'd want that to be ring-fenced. You don't want it piecemeal dotted around fields. You want it as a nice big circular block if you can get it, near to a point in the network where you can connect to the power grid. Normally that's fairly major substations, but increasingly it could be some major overhead power lines. The perfect site is completely unseen. Ideally you'd have trees all around it so you can't see onto it, but the trees aren't then casting a shadow onto the solar panels, so you get some and lose some. You don't really want footpaths or too many public views, or views from houses if possible. You want to be on low-grade agricultural land. Naturally, the planners and developers don't want to be taking the best quality food-producing land out of production. You want to use the worst quality land you can find so that we're not losing the food production potential of that land as much as possible. There will be lots of planning considerations. Probably the main thing is just making sure that we're not in any particular protected designation. We're not in a national park or an area of outstanding natural beauty. Greenbelt designations are a hurdle. There are some cases of developments in greenbelts, but they're relatively uncommon. So a little bit of digging, anything that you'd consider when you're looking at building a new shed, you'd probably think about with a solar farm as well.
And John, who can get involved in these kind of projects? Is it open to anybody in terms of people being an owner-occupier or on tenanted land?
I think after hearing Chris's answer, anyone with the landholding like Chris's would be ideal. But no, in all seriousness, owner-occupier is a key one. These schemes are sort of 30 to 40 years, so you need that ability to deliver a scheme over that time frame. So unfortunately, tenanted land, unless you've got an extremely friendly landlord, is unlikely to be an option. Age range, it doesn't matter. These are generational schemes due to the time frame. So a lot of stuff that we do early on is looking at tax planning, which we'll maybe come on to a bit later. But because of the time frame, it's making sure it's in the right person's hands when the scheme goes ahead to make sure that the family gets the most benefit in the long term.
it's a kind of a bit of an inactive diversification for many people. Unlike farm shops and, you know, holiday lets and things, that requires lots of time and labour from the farmer to run those as a business. Whereas this is really just becoming a landlord. You just rent out the land to the developer. There is a lot of work in the start of the process, working with the developer, getting planning permission, getting the project off the ground. But if it's successful, once it's built, you just act as a landlord, collect the rent checks every time they come in. And otherwise, you can carry on running your farm business around the solar farm without much of an impact. The real value is that it's just a secure income that's guaranteed for decades, and can easily then work as a replacement for the loss of BPS and other schemes that people have relied on in many cases.
John, what are the some of the biggest reservations that you found that people have when you start talking to them about solar?
I think I suppose the biggest reservation is moving away from farming itself, because a lot of people and a lot of clients that we work with, the reason why they do what they do isn't always necessarily a financial incentive. It's often a way of life and it's a lifestyle. It's something that they've done for generations. And once you have built a solar farm on your land, depending on size and scale, yes, you can graze sheep underneath it, but it's limited in its agricultural use. So I think the main reservation is moving away from farming. And, you know, that's a serious decision that people have to make. And it comes down to priorities and the financial return and everything else that goes with it. It does give opportunities. So if you could secure a scheme on your land, it gives you the ability to borrow against, and you could even go out and buy more agricultural land to continue doing what you're doing. But it's certainly a change that, you know, that there are visual impacts and all sorts of other reservations people have, but farming itself is the key one.
John, you mentioned there about the financial returns, and if the money's right, that people might be more likely to go for the opportunity. Shall we just drive straight in there and say, what are the kind of returns that people might expect, or are there big variability between different sites perhaps?
Yeah, there certainly is variability. I think as a ballpark guide, I think we look at everything between, I think the lowest we look at is sort of £600 per acre, up to anything £900, £950 in a very best case scenario, but they are quite few and far between. It really comes down to the cost of the grid connection. That's the real driver behind rent. Whichever developer a farmer decides to go with, they will make an application to the grid, and the grid will come back with a cost to connect in. And, you know, it's dependent on a lot of things. Things like whether they have to upgrade their own infrastructure to be able to make the connection, how far away you are, laying cables, you know, there's all sorts of variables that affect it. But it really does depend on what that cost is. That feeds then through to the rent. But I would say as a ballpark, £700, £750 an acre, you know, over a 30, 40 year lease is roughly where we seem to be getting deals done at the moment.
What are the other factors that you might need to consider when you're looking at whether a solar development is the right move for your farm?
There's obviously lots of things that play into it. Tax is obviously a big one that people get nervous about, because obviously once the solar farm's built, the land goes away from being agriculture and turns into a commercial unit, and therefore that does have tax implications. What I would say on the tax front is, you know, with the correct tax advice and organising yourself in the right way, you can still make a scheme very profitable and very financially beneficial. So it's one of those things, never let the tail waggle the dog, which is, you know, something that we do come across a lot. And as long as you've got the right tax advice early on, you can mitigate it and make sure it works. Land value as well, there is an element of land value change that differs greatly depending on how far you are through the process. So there's a few people, you know, that suggest if you're under an option, what effect does that have on land value? And I think in our experience, quite limited, mainly because of the number of sites that actually, whilst they're under an option, don't go right the way through the process and get built. So there may be an element of hope value early on, but it's not massive. Even once planning permission's granted, there's an argument to say that the number of projects that fall through at that stage is still quite high. So it's only really once the scheme is built out and functional when there's a real change in land value. And as long as that's planned for and put in the right place, then yeah, it's all manageable.
it's slightly different to other diversification opportunities in that presumably there's not much farmers can do to put themselves forward for a site, and that a lot depends on the suitability and the availability of the grid connection and those factors that you've just mentioned. But are there ways that people can be more proactive to improve their chances, or how do they go about identifying whether they might have a suitable site for development?
You do have to have a bit of an innate advantage of being in the right place at the right time. So if someone who is, you know, an upland hill farmer in an AONB suddenly phoned up and said they wanted to look at a solar farm, the chance of that happening is probably going to be quite slim. But it definitely does help to try and be proactive. There are developers out there, lots of developers looking for land, but the way that they find land can often be quite limited. One of the main resources they use is the land registry to find contact details, but land that's not registered, or if the addresses aren't up to date, often gets missed. Or even if it's just registered in lots of little parcels, it's not obvious to a developer that that's one big block of land all owned by the same owner. There are all sorts of ways that sites could be, you know, slipped through the net in that way. And then your neighbours might get approaches, but you don't. So we'd strongly recommend, if people are interested, to put themselves out there. One of the things that we do is we actively promote land to developers. We've got good relationships with lots of developers and have databases of them, and can easily have a look at a site ourselves, give a quick opinion as to whether we think it's any good, and even then get second opinions from developers within a matter of days.
We're going to speak to one of our clients who's been successful in securing a site, and he mentions within that he was actually approached by a few different developers before going with Lightsource, who are the ones who are actually constructing the site at the moment. Are there a lot of these kind of false starts, and what would be your advice to people who've had an approach from someone? How do you tell whether they're genuine and whether they're actually going to take the project forward?
My advice generally is not to go with the first person who goes and knocks on the door. That helps to draw attention to the fact that your site might be suitable and there might be people interested, but there are a lot of companies out there with limited experience, or, you know, without that much funding behind them. And it can be very valuable to do a bit of investigation on the company. What experience do they have? What is their offer? And then how does that compare to the rest of the market? You can either, you know, speak to someone who knows about the market and can give you an opinion straight away, or possibly go and speak to some other developers and generate some competing offers so you can really evaluate them with some context of what the market looks like.
Do you have an idea of what proportion of projects do make it to completion?
I work on a bit of a very rough rule of thumb of saying probably about 20% of sites that we look at actually lead to a successful project. The vast majority of those are going to be cases where we've had a little investigation, a grid application has been submitted by the developer, and they find that the connection to the grid is just completely unaffordable, and they pull the plug at that point with very little commitment from the landowner. There are some projects that fail at a later stage, but the majority of them fail fairly early on. But it is a high rate of failure, so I tend to work roughly on about 20%.
And John, is that something that people should be worried about in terms of the costs to them or to their business of moving through that process? You know, could it be that you start to incur costs and then the project fails, and where does that leave you as a landowner or as a farmer?
Yeah, it certainly can be an expensive process looking at it from the outside in. The benefit is working with the right developers at the right time. They do give some coverage on costs, which is the benefit. So the main cost very early on is the grid application cost. You know, it can cost in the region of, say, £10,000 to make an application to, you know, the grid to see what that connection cost would be. The developer will stump that cost right from the beginning, which is great from a landowner perspective, because at that stage, I suppose that's when it's the most risky and there's the most chance of it not coming to fruition. Once you get past that stage, there is an element of costs that do start to be incurred. But again, we as in working for a landowner, would get a fee undertaking early on to make sure that the developer would cover the costs if a final agreement's made and the landowner decides to go into an option. Of course, there are some costs which would be stumped by the landowner if they decided to pull out at any time. But if, again, we would try and get costs covered if it was the developer that pulled out or if the developer didn't get planning permission. So as long as you have a good relationship and an agreement with the developer, you can make sure that you can mitigate your risk to costs as the process goes through.
Do people ever try and take the process forwards themselves and take on the role of the developer instead of choosing to lease out the land?
I've been asked that question quite a lot, but I've never found anyone who has taken something of this scale forwards themselves. I don't know the full details of the finances behind these projects, but at the scale that we're involved in, talking potentially 200 acres worth of solar panels, that could be tens of millions of pounds worth of equipment. And unless you're a particularly high net worth individual, it's going to be difficult to raise that kind of finance. All of the work building up to that process takes tens, if not hundreds of thousands of pounds to make the grid connection, to get your planning permission, do the countless surveys that need to be done prior to that. I'm certainly not going to say it's impossible, but you'd have to have very deep pockets, deeper than anyone I've met so far.
Can these be schemes that groups of landowners can take forward together if people don't have enough land in isolation to put forward for development?
Absolutely. It can be relatively uncommon to find the perfect piece of land that's owned by a single individual. In terms of my schemes at the moment, I've got a mixture of projects, some with just a single landowner involved, some with maybe two or three, and one with five at the moment. There's no limit to how many people you can pull together. It just becomes a practical issue of making sure that you're working with people who are going to happily work together. If you're working with neighbours who people drink down the pub with on night, brilliant, they're good friends, they're hopefully going to cooperate with it. But if they've got any rivalries or anything like that, you probably don't want to be going into business with them.
Where is too far north to have a solar farm? Obviously, we're what some people would consider the depths of the deepest, darkest north up here in Yorkshire, but there are areas further north. And is there a limit to how far north you can go in order to get enough sunlight?
That's a very good question. The honest answer is, I don't know, because it's changing all the time. The technology is getting better and better. And as the costs of the technology drops, it then becomes more affordable to put these solar panels in less sunlit areas. The north of England is viable. County Durham is a reasonably good area. It's good because the power network is there, but the sunlight's quite poor, but it's okay. It's enough to make projects work. Getting into Northumberland, it is possible, but the grid network's not so strong in Northumberland. Scotland, I think, is a challenge. I think there are some projects planned in sort of the west coast of Scotland where they get relatively similar light levels to Durham. But once you get properly into deep Scotland, it's unlikely you're going to be doing anything on solar.
In the case study that we're going to hear from in a moment, the solar farm is grazed or will be grazed when it's completed. What's the purpose of that, John, that grazing around the panels? And does that apply to all sites? Can they all be grazed?
Yeah, it's a question we get asked a lot, is about grazing. It's normally the first one on a farmer's lips. Most developers do encourage it. They obviously don't like the vegetation growing so high that it would then interfere with sunlight on the panels. So they have an obligation throughout the term of the agreement to keep that grass down. So if you can deliver that via grazing, then, you know, it saves them a cost of paying someone to go in with a tractor and a cutter and keep on top of it. So they actively encourage it. Obviously, sheep are okay, horses, cows, no, due to obvious reasons. We are quite often get asked whether you can claim the BPS because you're grazing it with sheep. It's going to be a question that gets asked less with the BPS going, but the one thing I would say is no. Once those panels are built, it's a commercial site and it's not an agricultural landholding anymore, so I would steer away from claiming the BPS. one of the things that we do try and tie in with agreements is that that's not a guaranteed thing for the whole term of the agreement, so that the farmer gets the opportunity to graze it or look after the site if they want to, but it's not an obligation. So if in 5 years, 10 years, they decide that they're not interested in sheep or don't want to carry out that maintenance contract, the solar developer will then have to go and deliver that through a separate contractor. But the landowner gets first refusal is something that we always try and tie into our agreements.
You mentioned there about the land being taken out of agricultural production and being classed as something different. What happens when the agreement expires? Can that land be returned and be turned back into farmland? And are there difficulties there in terms of the productivity of the land? Is there any kind of residue or structural damage from the solar farm that might affect future productivity?
One of the key terms that we spend quite a bit of time with developers on is the decommissioning clauses within agreement. So the developer is obligated to return the site to agriculture at the end, and that ties in quite often with the planning permission, that the planning permission is a time limited planning permission, and it says that once the solar farm is finished in whether that's 30 or 40 plus years, it is returned to agriculture. They would remove all the kit, and like I just mentioned, we spend a bit of time making sure that those clauses are very tight so that they do have to remove everything and it can go back to being farmed. One of the worries that a lot of people have is that will there be a company at the end of the scheme capable of decommissioning? And we make sure that there's some strong protections and, you know, decommissioning funds and all that sort of stuff from a certain point in the agreement that builds up a fund which can be used at the end of the scheme to decommission if, for whatever reason, that the company that holds that solar farm is disappeared or gone bust. So, yeah, the decommissioning clauses are really important in terms of farming it afterwards. In a way, it's agricultural land that's had 40 years worth of rest, so it should, in theory, be very good to go back into production. Soil should have been protected, it'll have had a vegetation cover for that full time, so there's no reason why it shouldn't be able to go back into agricultural use once the scheme finishes.
For people looking at this as an opportunity now, or maybe for the next 5 to 10 years, do you think it's a relatively low risk venture for people? Do you think it's an area that's going to grow, an area of opportunity, or should people maybe take it with a little bit of pinch of salt because it's here today and gone tomorrow?
I think it's probably a bit of both, really. I think one of the biggest limiting factors that I can see at the moment is the capacity of the power network to take connections of this type. The power network was always built to take single big coal power plants or nuclear power plants at the centre to distribute power out gradually into smaller and smaller locations. And what we're doing with renewables, whether it's solar or wind or any other technology, is we're reversing the system. We're pumping power in at the distributed level backwards up the network in a way that it was never designed to do. So because of that, there is a bit of a race on at the moment of the finite areas where there is capacity is where there's the most interest for building these projects. And naturally, as that finite resource gets consumed, there are going to be fewer and fewer occasions where a site's going to be suitable. So I think to some extent, the lifetime of this opportunity is limited. Because once all of the capacity is taken up, or at least in any local area, once it's taken up, it's going to be difficult to go and put a new project in again. But that said, I do think there's still going to be some long-term opportunities for other technologies. Seeing how solar has evolved, how a few years ago it was subsidized and now there's no subsidy and it's still working. As the cost of the panels drops, maybe the scale of the projects can change that might find new connection opportunities on the grid. But also there's a huge amount of money globally going into renewable and low carbon technologies. I've heard all sorts of information about people looking at solar powered electric car charging forecourts that might then be an opportunity, not at 200 acre scale, but that might be a different opportunity that suddenly is presented to farmers who might have the right locations. Similarly, there's also talk about hydrogen refineries as that being a way of storing and preserving energy. And if you're producing electricity from something like a solar farm, you can use that electricity to create hydrogen and then either sell that or burn it when power's on demand. So I definitely think there is still going to be a future demand for land for energy technologies. I just don't think that this scale of solar development is going to last forever. It's a window of opportunity that everyone should explore and take the advantage of, but there might still be something else in the future.
Are there still opportunities there for people locally? We are in an area where there is currently capacity within the grid, but are there still eligible sites out there that have yet to be found?
Yeah, absolutely. We've been dealing with a couple this last fortnight, in fact, where, you know, there are very good sites that have come forward that have capacity, can connect into the grid at an affordable level, and hopefully will end up being a developable site. So yeah, they are reducing quickly, and we may find that we may go to sort of the phase two of developments in the next 3 to 4 years, where the very best, the most financially viable have been snapped up, and we go slightly further afield, which might not be quite as financially viable, but still makes sense. So, like Chris said, there is a race at the moment to snap up that capacity, but what's not to say that the capacity doesn't change in the next 10 years? There's no reason why there can't be investment into the grid, which helps change that. And we have seen substations that have gone from showing having no capacity to some capacity within a couple of years. So it's a very, very fast moving market at the moment. And the one thing I will say is that if people do think they have an opportunity, you know, pick up the phone and we'll speak to them. You've got to review every opportunity when you review it and not look too far into the future. I have come across sites in the past where people have just thought, well, you know, we'll wait and see what happens. Something better might come along and in 2 years' time. And next thing they know, that opportunity's gone and somebody else has taken it. So whenever an opportunity like this does arise, you've got to look at it. You've got to see whether it works for that farming business or that individual. And if it does, you could wait it out and see if something better comes 5 years in the line, but there'll always be a risk that you miss that opportunity.
Thanks very much, John. We are now going to hear from somebody who has definitely grasped that opportunity. Mark Hinton is a GSC Grays client who was approached by solar developers Lightsource in 2019. And his solar farm is now nearing completion. We talked to him about his experience of the development process, from the first knock on the door to some archaeological surprises.
My name's Mark Hinton, and I'm a partner in DA Hinton and Son, the other partner being my father. We've lived at West and South Lowfield since 1987, and that's when we came here, and it's a sort of mixed farm. 500 acres, sort of approximately 300 acres of arable, 100 acres of grassland, and there'll be 80 acres of woodland. And it was mixed. We've had sheep, cattle, and we've recently just had pigs. We introduced pigs in a bed and breakfast scenario. And when the solar idea came along, it seemed to naturally be the route to follow, really, you know, financially and also for the, you know, to utilize, diversify, I suppose, to do, you know, get an income stream outside your, you know, your crops, and your livestock.
How did the idea for the solar first come about?
That's the interesting thing, really, because it isn't really anything I did. The solar companies have people who are out there searching for sites that are suitable, and that the suitability is dependent on the availability on the grid, first of all. You know, there has to be available grid capacity. And then I think in the south now, it's probably a problem, but up here there has been less development, so there is grid availability. So their first thing is they will just go on a map and then find or contact Northern Power Grid or whoever to see whether there's grid space available, and if there is, they'll then look at the suitability of the land, whether it's flat, whether which way it's sloping, and obviously for the sun. And then when it gets, I suppose, one of the things they don't want is a lot of public access over the particular site, because once the site's up and running, they don't really want access to the general public because of the amount of equipment that's on site. So, you know, realistically, it isn't anything I've done specifically. It is the suitability of the area, the farm. One thing I will say is we did do, over the years, we've done a lot of tree planting, and a lot of it's been screening from the village point of view. So that has helped a lot, having a lot of that screening in place, because when you go to the centre of the site, as it now is, you can't see anything.
It was Lightsource that came to you originally, wasn't it? On a map, they saw that your land fit the bill really nicely for them because it was largely out of public view, but close to a substation with a good grid connection.
Lightsource was the third company to approach me. I don't think the first two companies even exist now. I think they came, they sort of looked at the suitability and said, yes, no, it's really good. And then I heard no more. So when Lightsource came along, I was possibly a bit blasé and didn't really sort of get too excited because I'd had two companies prior to that. But I could gradually, in a fairly short space of time, you could begin to see Lightsource were definitely there to take it forwards. I kept fingers crossed and everything crossed, hoping that they would. And in the end, it has come through, yes.
Is that quite common, Chris, that you get approaches from a developer and then they disappear and you never hear anything more from them?
Unfortunately, yeah. The thing is, there are that many developers out there at the moment that some of them are big companies with lots of reputation, lots of resources, who are, you know, putting a lot of work into targeting sites and taking them forwards. But there are quite a few smaller companies out there who might not have the resources and might only be able to take on a couple of sites. And so they'll write to people, they'll get as many people interested, but if they can only take, say, five sites forwards, they'll find the first five that reply and then ignore all the other people that they've written to. Or their situation in the grid changes and some other developer gets in that connection before we do and beats us in the queue, really. It's a competitive first come, first serve process. Yeah.
So you're obviously quite keen, Mark, to get the opportunity off the ground. What were your key motivations for wanting to really take that forwards?
I would say predominantly the way farming was heading. You know, it was coming under extreme pressure, and we were going to have to, BPS is disappearing or coming back as Elms and things like that. And I just felt that I needed an income, that this is a guaranteed income stream. And hopefully with what land I've got left, I'll still be able to take that forwards. But I do feel a unit of our size would not have survived going forwards without this kind of income stream from the diversification. I'm not saying everyone's going to struggle, but a lot. I think we would have done, definitely.
Mark, how did the local community and your neighbours and local farmers react to the planning application and to the proposals?
I got a strange reaction from some local farmers who were sort of, not envious, but were sort of, oh, well, do you think they'll be interested in any more? But I think I was surprised a bit how well the local community seemed to embrace it. But it did tie in, the timing was so fortunate because the government had been pushing for renewable projects. I think what the local community felt was it wasn't actually impacting on them. They wouldn't, you know, see it, but it's happening in their parish or their community. And I think some of them were. The only reservations we got was the when it's under construction, and there's obviously a lot of transport in and out with wagons delivering stuff. And that was the only little sort of gremlin, I suppose, that they were worried about, because it is a rural community. The roads aren't particularly good. But having said that, light source have invested a certain amount in the local parish, and also they had to get all the highways and everything on board, so there wasn't any more they could do essentially.
I was pleasantly surprised when we put the planning application in and looked at the public comments, because as you say, that there are a couple of objections based on the transport issues, but there were some quite surprising unprompted letters of support that we got from a few local residents, and I can't remember who it was, but there was one in particular that I remember of someone saying that they actively supported it because they felt like their community was involved in a renewable project, and you know, they know that we need renewables, we need to be environmental to do something to combat climate change, and they really enjoyed the thought that their community is part of the solution rather than the problem.
As well as the planning process, I presume there are also lots of other hoops to jump through in order to get to the point of actually starting to construct the site. How long does that process take? And maybe, Chris, you could start by kind of giving us an overview of the key stages that you have to work through.
The very first thing to work out is whether there's a grid connection, because it's no good producing power if you can't sell it to anyone or can't connect it into the network. So that's always the fundamental point. As long as you're close to a relatively big substation, you're in with a reasonable chance. The developers will investigate the grid connection. There's always going to be a cost for making that connection, and that largely dictates whether the project's going to succeed or fail. In Mark's case, we have to run a cable a couple of kilometres, I think, to get to the substation, and it's going through three, I think, different farmers.
Yeah, I think so. Who were all supportive, but thankfully.
The nice thing has been that Lightsource have done all of that work, haven't they? We've not had to work too hard engaging the landowners. Lightsource, it's their project. They've spoken with the neighbours. They've worked out sensible deals with them to lay cables and get access to the grid. So that was the biggest fundamental hurdle at the beginning. After that, planning was then the next big hurdle. But what a lot of people don't realise is the work that goes in before then. I can't remember how long we had, but maybe 9 months or so worth of preparation work, doing lots of surveys, lots of designs and studies, building this package of information so that when the application went in, the council had everything they needed to make their decision. After planning was granted, it was then a relatively efficient process of working from that to getting a construction on site. Behind the scenes, Lightsource had to do work dealing with funders and doing deals to sell the electricity to consumers. But as soon as those deals had been done in the background, they were then ready to commit and fairly quickly actually said they wanted to get started and push the paperwork forwards and, got on site as soon as they could.
They did all the sonar, didn't they, of the whole site, where they virtually did every square inch of the site. And that did actually throw up one interesting thing of a settlement on 10 acres of it, right in the middle of the site. So that rather, I was beginning to think, oh no, is this the beginning of the end?
I was with you, Mark, at that. When we saw the results of the survey and the expert had commented saying they found what they think could be a medieval village completely unknown to anyone right in the centre of the site, my heart sunk and thought, that's the end of it, the project's dead. But I was surprised that for quite some time they were considering continuing with solar panels on top of the medieval village, because they believed that 40 years of having solar panels just sat on the surface, not doing anything, would preserve it far better than the farm plough going through it every season for the next 40 years. So they were tempted to do that. But as you say, you had enough land that they were able to redesign it and to save the hassle of trying to run that argument with the archaeologists. They thought they can just pull away from it. There's still enough land to build a big project and the project remains unaffected.
And how long is the construction process likely to take?
I think with the weather conditions as they are, slightly longer. I think possibly it's going to be nearer 7 months. Although the original plan, and they say they'll still hopefully hit it, is to actually start producing electric in May. So I think that might be a bit optimistic, but it'll all depend what the weather does in the next 3 months.
What does the site look like at the moment?
Interesting.
As far as I can tell, this is probably the worst imaginable time for them to do a construction because the weather's absolutely abysmal. We've had Brexit in the middle of that and we're in a COVID lockdown yet again. And they've been bringing workers in from Europe and the parts that they're bringing in for construction are coming from China and all over the world. And you know, despite all of the political issues and the national problems, amazingly, it's having a relatively small impact on them. It seems like the rain is the bigger problem than all the political issues at the moment.
The amount of signage they've had to do is quite incredible. But when you get a Turkish lorry driver who can't read English and he appears up at the house, I was rather pleased if he had turned up at my house and no one else's.
Sounds like it's a benefit to have a sense of humour through the whole process.
Oh, absolutely. Because I'm on site most of the time, it's been a huge benefit because I've been able to, when they've found a drain or something like that, I've been able to work with them. We have come across a main drain that I didn't know where it went, and they've managed to establish it. And we're going to try and possibly divert it slightly with an open ditch. But that's where it's been, from my perspective, been very good to be on site. Because at the end of the day, I'm still going to farm this land, whether the sheep that graze under them will be mine or someone else's. But someone's got to do it. So we don't want the whole site sort of standing in 2-3 inches of water. So we need to get a lot of these drains and things so they are running, not damaged.
Naturally, when you've got a construction project of this size, there's always going to be problems. And we've had some issues in the past, haven't we, with the boundary fences being in the wrong locations and a few areas here and there. But at the same time, there's been a lot of kind of favours passing back and forth, haven't there? That, you know, I know you would lend them a vehicle for a while when it was really muddy. And likewise, they've then been, you know, doing you a few favours. And it seems everyone's pulling in the same direction because ultimately, we all want to see this succeed. We all benefit from seeing this work. So no matter what issues we come across, we've all managed to pull together to resolve the issues and get the project to where it is now.
You mentioned a bit there about the challenges of trying to kind of farm, well, at the moment around the construction site, but I suppose in the future it'd be around the solar farm itself. What will your farming business look like now or when the solar farm is complete? How will you then continue to farm on the rest of the land? Will it be markedly different to what you were doing before?
I think one of the things a lot of the villagers thought, which, you know, we said at the time, is at least you can still farm under them. In other words, we'll have to sow the grass and then the sheep graze under them. And I think it'll be a very extensive way of farming. I think, you know, there won't be many sheep per acre because you won't be able to fertilise this land. So, you know, going forwards, that'll be my thinking there. We still have the other 100 acres or so of grass, so I'll still probably have a number of cattle, and there'll be a much smaller area of arable, but we do work with a neighbour and the person I employ, because I have one employee, he then drives the combine for a neighbour, and we also cut another 300 acres for someone else. So essentially, yeah, the farming business is going to change, but we will still be farming.
In a way, farm as much or as little as you like at the moment, because the structure allows us to take the grazing if you want to take it, but equally, if for whatever reason you decided sheep just weren't for you and you had no interest in cutting that grass, unless LightSource can find someone else to graze it, you know, they're responsible for taking care of that grass. So in your case, if you wanted to just, close the gates and not have to worry about it, you can do that. But equally, there's 200 odd acres of grass that's costing you nothing, but is sat there with the opportunity for you to get a key, walk in and put sheep on it. So it's land for nothing, really, isn't it?
How is that agreement structured then with Lightsource?
So the solar farm is under a tenancy. So it's a commercial tenancy that's not particularly dissimilar from agricultural tenancies or anything like that. Everything that Lightsource are renting is their responsibility and ultimately their, almost like their property. So Mark still owns the ground underneath the panels, but Lightsource are responsible for all of the kit that's on there. If anything breaks, they have to fix it. They're responsible for taking care of it. And the grazing is a sort of optional thing that we've built into that as a separate deal. So it works like a grazing license, because technically the grass is going to be their property. We can then take a license for free to come in and graze the grass with sheep. So it ensures that Mark's not got any responsibility for the site and no liability for what happens on it. Lightsource have, within reason, freedom to maintain and run the kit. But at the end of the lease, in about 40 years' time, the planning consent will expire and the lease will expire, and they'll have to rip up the whole site, reinstate it back to farmland, and return it back to Mark, ready to be farmed from day one again.
Don't know if it'll be me, Chris.
There's one final question that we do ask all our participants in the podcast, Mark, which is a general question. And it's, what is the biggest change in the agricultural landscape that you've seen in your career?
Well, I think diversification is one of them. I think you don't have to, you look at other people, what they've done in golf courses, everything. And I think once over, for years, people would just farm and farm the same way. But diversification, or the whole concept of it's come along. And I think that's the biggest change in agriculture. People aren't just necessarily doing beef, sheep and arable. The way farmers have adjusted to it, because we're not, essentially we trained as farmers. And yeah, some of these diversification projects, especially if they involve a farm shop or something, you're then dealing with the general public, which we're not all brilliant at. I'm not. Fortunately, I won't have to deal with the general public.
Thank you, Chris, Mark and John, and thank you all for listening. The Changing Landscape programme will continue next month, when we'll be exploring how you can make environmental management work for your business and respond to the move to public money for public goods. Follow us on social media to keep track of the campaign, or sign up to receive content via email by sending your name and address to changinglandscape@gscgrays.co.uk. Thank you for listening.